All right.
We're back right under the, we're studying Baptist spread throughout Europe, and we're looking at the, we just finished the fifth monarchy. Man. Okay. Roughly page 99. After the death of Cromwell, and that's where we left England with Cromwell ruling as sort of the dictator and no king. After the death of Cromwell, his son couldn't keep his government together. And that sounds like a negative statement about the son, but if you read anything about him, he's famous for just being a really nice guy. And a nice man, didn't want to hurt anybody, etc. But unfortunately, if you're going to lead a church, at times you have to do difficult things. If you're going to lead a school, at times you have to expel students. If you're going to lead a business, at times you have to fire people. If you're going to lead a country, at times there come times when somebody has to be dealt with harshly and with great strength. And Cromwell's son just couldn't do that. And so things began to slip badly. Faced with anarchy, the English restored the son of Charles I, Charles II, to the throne. Charles II had fled during the Civil War, was living in France. They made arrangements to bring him back and restore him to the throne. Well, before the Restoration, Charles had given his word to support religious freedom. But old saying, you know how you can tell when a politician's lying to you? His lips are moving. He promised. But when he got back, he soon broke his word, persecuting all nonconformists as well as the Puritan element within the established church. In fact, he also promised not to take action against any of those who'd put his father to death. He broke that word too, even executing the Cromwell's son, who'd had no part in it, just because he was Cromwell's son. Many Baptists were imprisoned and fined, but none were officially executed for being Baptist. None were officially executed for being Baptist. However, several Baptist preachers were executed for other charges that seemed very suspect. All clergy who taught the sole authority of Scripture were expelled from the Church of England. Benjamin Keach, K-E-A-C-H. Benjamin Keach, a Baptist pastor, wrote a book for children, explaining Baptist principles to them. We could use a book like that today. He was arrested, his books confiscated and burned. He was placed in stocks, and a local mob was permitted to pelt him with garbage and refuse. Without going into details, trust me when I tell you, this was not a pleasant experience. He was placed in stocks, and a local mob was permitted to pelt him with garbage and refuse. Charles appointed William Laud, L-A-U-D, as the head of the Church of England. Laud's claim to fame was his hatred of Baptists. As I've mentioned previously, anybody in a position of leadership, no matter how many things they believe in or involved in, will be remembered for two or three things in their lifetime that stands out as dominant. One of the things he's remembered about, I mean, this sums up his life, he hated Baptists. And I would not want to be remembered for as one of the most dominant things about my life, hating anybody, no matter what their faults were. He's credited with making the statement, "I could be content to see an Anabaptist go to hell on a Brownist back." And Brownists were the Congregationalists. 1641, Laud was convicted of high treason and removed from office. Persecution of Baptists continued, but it was more isolated and sporadic than it had been in the past. During this time, the established English church turned from its ancient practice of immersion of infants. All the time of its existence, when it is baptizing babies the way the Catholic Church had, it baptized them by immersion. But it turned away during this time and began sprinkling. By 1648, the immersion of anyone was outlawed. They actually produced a lectionary which gave the definitions of Greek words, and they made the definition of baptizo sprinkle, which is not the way the word was ever used, but they put it in the lectionary figuring to fool everybody, so when you looked it up, that's what it meant. However, there were so many people that knew Greek, that didn't fly, and they weren't able to continue it. By 1648, immersion of anyone was outlawed. You see the same thing. Baptism by immersion in Syria is outlawed. The Greek Orthodox Church and Roman Catholic Church are legal, but they both sprinkle babies. And so they can have a ceremony like that in their church without it being illegal. But a baptism by immersion is illegal, which is why they don't baptize every week. And they never baptize in the same place twice. Yeah. If they baptized every week, that would get found out. If they baptized in the same place, that would be known as a place for baptism and you would get caught. They baptize maybe once every couple years. And they always baptize in a location where they've never baptized before. Well, after the death of Charles II, his brother James II became the ruling monarch. Daniel Defoe, author of the famous novel Robinson Crusoe, identified with the Baptist. He also wrote in the Defense of Religious Freedom, was twice arrested for his writings. You find his most famous book by far is Robinson Crusoe. But also in other books of his, you find him dealing with religious issues, liberty issues, and Christian apologetics in the books, and defense of liberty in the books. And they were really written for a purpose. Robinson Crusoe is the only one that really became famous. And in its various Hollywood incarnations, they missed the purpose. And you don't find anything similar to the kind of things that Defoe put in there. And Defoe did, he took fiction, but used fiction to illustrate the truth. And when Hollywood took it, they just got the fiction part and the truth evaporated. But I mean, they can't get Noah and the book of Genesis right, so I'm not surprised they can't get Defoe right. It amazed me to read Robinson Crusoe the first time I read it. I'd seen, you know, a couple movie versions of it, and that was the story. And then I read it, and I found all this Christian stuff there that absolutely amazed me. Well, he got arrested for doing that a couple times. Under James II, the same general treatment of Baptists continued, and the Baptists opposed him by a violent revolution. But they weren't strong enough to make something like that work. By a violent revolution, but the revolt was crushed. And many, including the two grandsons of William Kiffin, were arrested and scheduled for execution. He was a pretty famous Baptist preacher in England. His grandsons participated in the revolt. Most revolts are carried out by people in their teens and 20s, with the energy and sometimes impetuousness of youth. That same things. You see, when they overthrew the dictator in Ukraine, that was primarily a revolution of the young. And I'm not being critical of him. He was not worthy of rule. But now that he's overthrown, they're in a conflict with Russia that they don't have the military for, and men much older than the folks who marched in the streets are trying to figure out what to do. Again, I'm not being critical. We wouldn't have won the American War for Independence without the impetuousness of youth. The aged Kiffin managed to get an audience with the king, and he pleaded for their lives without success. One of the most famous of all Baptists lived during this period, John Bunyan. John Bunyan. Bunyan preferred to call himself an independent. But it is clear he taught all the Baptist distinctives. He was arrested 3 times for preaching without being licensed by the Church of England. And those arrests led to a total of over 12 years in prison. He had a mandatory 6-year prison term for preaching without a license. He gets arrested for preaching without a license, is in prison for 6 years, gets out, and the next Sunday he preaches again. Gets prosecuted and convicted. I mean, if you acknowledge that as a crime, there was no defense because he clearly did it. He gets convicted, spends 6 more years in prison. First Sunday out, preaches without license. Gets arrested, convicted, serves 6 months, and they abolished prison terms for that crime, and they let him out. And they still would fine people, but he did not serve much of the third term. While in prison, he wrote the Christian classic, The Pilgrim's Progress, as well as many of the books. The Pilgrim's Progress has been the most highly regarded Christian book ever written, apart from the Bible, of course. Christianity Today magazine at one time asked a survey, and they asked 100 well-known preachers, what was the most influential book on you? Obviously outside the Bible. What's the most influential book on you? And 52 out of 100, out of all the books that have been printed, picked Pilgrim's Progress. Well, I didn't make the list of 100 famous preachers, but had they asked me, I would also have said Pilgrim's Progress. Bunyan was finally released from prison and continued several years as a very popular preacher. Both Charles II and James II took note of his popularity. He died only 3 months before religious freedom came to England. Finally, the English people overthrew James II in what is remembered as the Glorious or Bloodless Revolution. James had such little support, he had to flee to France for his safety. He couldn't find an army to defend him. The military turned on him. Again, that is the key in every revolution, is what will the military do? The English appealed to William III, King of Holland, to become their new king. William III, King of Holland, who was already famous for defending religious freedom. He happens to be married to James's daughter. So they overthrow James, and then in England, of course, the issue is relation, blood claims to the throne. So the argument was, if James II is not allowed to be king, who is the closest relative to the throne? And there were folks who made an argument at being older children that they would be closer. But they knew what Mary's husband was like, how he had stood for freedom for the people in Holland. So they assumed correctly that, of course, if she came to England, he would come as well. Technically, she'd be the queen and he'd be the royal consort, but they were pretty comfortable with his influence and what it would mean and got exactly what they bargained for. He was also descended from William the Silent and Maurice. He held their same views of liberty and religious freedom, and he quickly established relative religious freedom in England. The days of fines and imprisonment were over. And you get some indication of the character of William, and we mentioned this early in the semester. It may take on more significance now with all we've seen, but William authorizes 2 theology professors to write a book. And he wants in the book them to explain what church is the closest in its doctrine and practice to the church of the New Testament. He's a Calvinist, goes to a Calvinist church. So you know what he expects they're going to find, that the Calvinist church is closest. But 2 honest professors, they produce a book and document how the Baptists were the closest to the church of the New Testament. He goes ahead and pays for its being printed and distributed anyway. By the middle of the 19th century, we're now jumping, okay, a couple hundred years. By the middle of the 19th century, there were over 2,400 Baptist churches in England. 2,400. They're flourishing. They're all over the place now. They're not in a majority, but everywhere you go in the country, they are. It's something like what people have called the Filipino Revival. 1949, you found the first Independent Baptist Church. Now, 60-some years later, there are over 4,000. I mean, you see something like this in England during the same time frame. There were a number of regular Baptist publications and at least 11 Baptist colleges. Most Baptists had united for the purpose of promoting missions. And this organization was called the Baptist Union. The period of revival known as the Great Awakening, had a great effect on English Baptists. But the most influential preachers of the Great Awakening were John Wesley, the Arminian founder of the Methodist, and George Whitefield, an independent Calvinist. Many of the converts of the Great Awakening joined Baptist churches. George Whitefield, independent Calvinist. Whitefield would later write that many of his young chicks had become ducks. Chicks, newly born, new converts. Ducks put their head under the water when they fish. And so he said many of his young chicks had become ducks. They'd been immersed. Perhaps the most famous English Baptist was Charles Haddon Spurgeon. Charles Haddon Spurgeon. And again, we've said volumes of his sermons were published in the 1800s, later 1800s. I should not have said early. And long after his death, every single book of his sermons is still in print. They're all over the place. I have a number of them, which again shows you how influential they were. They survived long after his lifetime. Well, Spurgeon, whose father and grandfather had been independent preachers, Spurgeon had been saved as a youth in a Methodist church, and his own study of the Scripture convinced him of the reality of the Baptist distinctives. During his youth, Spurgeon and his father became famous for tag team preaching. They would both come, and one would preach this point of a message, and one would preach another point of the message. And they had a message on Baptist distinctives. And his father would step down and say, Charles does a better job on this one than I do. And he'd preach that one. And then a father would come back up and preach the next one. And unusual type of sermon. His own study of the Scripture convinced him of the reality of Baptist distinctives. Spurgeon built a huge church in London, easily the largest church in the world during that time. It's actually so large, you're only allowed to come to one service a week. They had Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, but you could only come to one service a week, and you got tickets ahead of time for that service. And you're only allowed to come to one. They had a huge, several thousand seat auditorium. Underneath that was a 500 seat auditorium, and they had a prayer meeting for the service above every service, and that would fill with 500 people praying for God's blessing on the service that was taking place just above them. Okay. That's done without a bus ministry, without radio, without any of the things we normally think as church growth methods today. Well, he became a national figure in England, and his sermons and comments were printed in newspapers around the world. In those days, it was considered fashionable for a Sunday newspaper to have a sermon that started on the front page. We can't even imagine that today. But Spurgeon became the most famous preacher in the world because so many newspapers wanted his sermons. And so the English language newspaper in Beijing, China, every Sunday had a Spurgeon sermon on it. The Japanese language newspaper in Tokyo, Japan, had a translated Spurgeon sermon on it. New York City, etc., all over, when you went to the Sunday paper, there was, on the front page began, it would take several more pages, but on the front page would begin a Spurgeon sermon. And that happened with other preachers, but some folks said Spurgeon was on the front page of more Sunday newspapers than all the other preachers put together. He started his own college for the purpose of training preachers. Started his own college for the purpose of training preachers. Church still exists, runs about 300 in that vast auditorium, is Calvinist today. People go there and they provide tours, you know, for you to see the different aspects, but it's just, anyway, not anything that resembles Spurgeon. Spurgeon's glory days, when people had to arrive early to get a seat at his church or even get tickets, are usually what are most remembered about Spurgeon. However, there's another very important side to his ministry that reveals his character and principled position. His character and principled position. By the time Spurgeon became prominent, there were growing doctrinal differences among the pastors in the Baptist Union. Doctrinal differences. We said most of the Baptist churches, not all of them, but most of them had united into a fellowship called the Baptist Union. Well, by Spurgeon's time, some leading English Baptists were denying the inerrancy of Scripture. They were denying the inerrancy of Scripture. They said the spiritual lessons in the Bible are true, but that doesn't mean all the details are true. That doesn't mean Genesis 1 is true about creation. They're denying the inerrancy of Scripture, while others taught universalism. Universalism, the idea that eventually everyone would be saved. Universalism, the idea that eventually everyone would be saved. Religion goes through fads. And this is the fad of the late 1800s and early 1900s, universalism. It said everybody's going to be saved someday. Don't have to worry about hell or your loved ones being lost. And the issue is, do you want to enjoy the blessings of salvation now, or do you want to wait till eternity to enjoy them? And that is almost unheard of, anybody teaching that today. But it was the religious fad of a period of time. And during Spurgeon's day, they were teaching that in some of the Baptist churches in England. Spurgeon openly fought against these heresies. He openly fought against these heresies and identified the false teachers by name. He'd preach in his sermon, in his sermons in his church. He'd preach in the chapels in his college. He would do this with articles in his newspaper. And he would say, so-and-so at such and such place, you know, teaches universalism. And he would give quotes and said, this is heresy. Shouldn't be accepted in a Baptist church. And he said, someone else said, well, this is an error, and such is an error in the Bible, but we can draw real spiritual lessons from the story anyway. And he'd identify them by name, give quotes, and say, they should not be accepted as Baptists, which is the truth. This is often called the downgrade controversy. The downgrade controversy. He's accusing them of downgrading the Baptist faith. This is often called the downgrade controversy. He tried to get the Baptist Union to take a stand and expel these churches. They wouldn't. After the Baptist Union failed to take a clear stand on these issues, Spurgeon withdrew from the group. And representatives of the Baptist Union later voted 2,050-7 to condemn him as divisive. Spurgeon's own brother, James, presented the motion. I'll bet that was a favorite topic at Christmas dinners after that. While Spurgeon remained the most prominent preacher in England, his popularity suffered, and he was never again very far from controversy. Still had a large church, but you no longer had to get a ticket to get into a service, and you could go as many services as you wanted because the crowds weren't gathered outside. They say, well, he's a troublemaker. He's jealous. He's divisive. He's unfair. He's got a critical spirit. Spurgeon's concern about the Baptist Union proved to be realistic. proved to be realistic. Within 50 years of the downgrade controversy, modernism had completely taken over the English Baptist movement. So today, there's lots of Baptist churches in England. Almost none of them believe the Bible is inerrant. Almost none of them believe the cross is the way of salvation. And many of them campaign openly for things we would consider heretical or are immoral. And what Spurgeon said was the truth. The warning he gave proved to be right. People didn't listen. Fought the same battle in the American Baptist Convention in the United States. And the early people who tried to point out that there were modernists in the convention, that they were bitterly accused. And the battle's still being fought in the Southern Baptist Convention. Some people think it isn't, that the conservatives have won, but they still finance liberal seminaries. So it's hard for me to believe they've won. Just down at Florida Baptist College a couple weeks ago, and there was a young man in the student body there that had just transferred from a Southern Baptist college, wanting something more conservative. But I think he found maybe more conservative than he imagined. What Spurgeon said was right. If you tolerate heresy, it grows. And it came to take over the whole thing. And he looked down the road, and he could see that coming. Very quickly, because we'll mention it again, I think Friday. But this was implanted upon me early, because I went to the Bible college headed up by Ford Porter. Ford Porter had been pastor of the First Baptist Church in Princeton, Indiana, in the American Baptist Convention in the 1930s, when people began to raise the issue, there's something wrong, there's modernism in the colleges in our convention, and they're turning out modernist preachers. Well, usually you saw the modernism most strongly in the big cities like Chicago, and that would become an issue when a modernist tried to take over Ravenswood Baptist Church while I pastor today, and the church threw them out in 1934. Well, Ford Porter heard this, that there were modernism. There's modernism in the convention seminaries. Didn't want to believe it. So he drove from Princeton, Indiana to Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, where there was a seminary at that time. Went in, sat in a class, heard a teacher teach that the Bible was not inerrant. Leaves the class, marches to the American Baptist Convention office, which was on the property, and says, "What are we going to do about this?" He'd actually been given a list of names of teachers supposed to be modern. So he went and sit down one of them, proved it. Went in the office, and he said, "Well, that's only one." And Ford Porter's response was exactly what it should be. "One is one too many. One is one more than I'll tolerate." So he goes back and explains it to his church, and they vote to leave the convention. And the convention says you can't leave. It's true, you can't vote to leave the United Methodist. You can't vote to leave the Catholic Church. The organization controls the church. The convention, you can't leave. And he said, "Yes, we can. We're Baptists. Baptists are independent. It's one of the distinctives." He said, "No, you can't leave the convention. You belong to us." This went to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court ruled that by definition, Baptist churches were independent, and you could not make them belong to anything they didn't belong to. And that court case established that as a legal precedent in the United States. I'm not sure today I would trust the court to study church history that well. But they got it right then. And so from then on, anytime a church wanted to leave a Baptist convention, it had already been established legally that they could leave. Well, Spurgeon, Ford Porter, men of that nature, looked at these things. They said, if you tolerate one weed in the garden and you don't do anything about it, you know what you get? You get weeds all over the garden. And they held to this, and this was the original concept of fundamentalism, was that we refused to work with or tolerate modernism in any way. And I remember when the book History of Fundamentalism came out, I was a student at Indiana Baptist College. And I was in the bookstore. And when the books arrived, and he was there, he was waiting for them to arrive and get in, because he wanted to see how they told that story, how the book covered that story. And he was disappointed it didn't get covered in a book called The History of Fundamentalism. And it should have been covered because it was a huge part of the history of fundamentalism. I have a little book, I think long out of print, that he wrote on the story of what happened. And of course, it was the last years where he was active, and he would talk about this in chapel and to the students. And we heard him recount it, you know, and what happened and all that. So I got this well planted on me early. Again, every preacher gets noted for three or four things, two or three things. That was one of the things he was noted for. The stand he took and willing to fight the battle in court and open the door for everybody to leave the modernist conventions. Okay. Spurgeon was right. He quit being the most popular preacher you've ever heard of, and he didn't draw the large crowds, and etc. But he was right. We'll pick back up with that in the morning. God bless y'all. Have a good chapel.